Hey listeners, Chloe here. If you need to stay as up to date with the latest developments and innovations in the luxury industry as I do, you need to dive into Vogue Business. It's your ticket to a global perspective on fashion and beauty, delivering exclusive insights that will give you the edge in this competitive, dynamic industry. Just visit VogueBusiness.com today and use the code RUN20 at checkout to join the Vogue Business community. That's VogueBusiness.com, promo code RUN20. Don't miss out.
In the fashion community, American designers Calvin Klein, Donna Karan, and Ralph Lauren are sometimes referred to as the Big Three. As creators of hallmarks like Calvin Klein jeans, Donna Karan's Seven Easy Pieces, or the ubiquitous Ralph Lauren polo, these three designers became household names, ultimately establishing the American fashion industry as a major player in the fashion world. They designed simple, practical clothes that fit into the American lifestyle, and marketed that lifestyle to the world.
Welcome to In Vogue, the 1990s, a podcast about a pivotal time that ushered in a new era in fashion and in culture. Join us as we examine the defining moments of the decade that shaped fashion as we know it today. We'll hear from fashion leaders, cultural icons, and Vogue's own editorial team. I'm Anna Winter.
And I'm Hamish Bowles, Vogue's International Editor-at-Large and your host. When I was growing up in Britain, it was cool to look American. As far as we understood it, American style was this very casual, cool look. Even the very coolest kids in high school were called the casuals. I mean, the casuals in Britain were a particular kind of tribal substrata of achingly cool hipster kids. The casuals would be wearing an Adidas bomber something or maybe Ralph Lauren logo polo shirts. They dressed themselves completely in this look. Compared to the rest of us, it was unmistakable. They just looked very American to my eyes. Which is a style that's hard to define, but easy to spot.
What is American fashion?
That's kind of an existential question.
Robin Gavan is a noted fashion historian and author, and she was a former editor at Vogue.
I mean, I think American fashion is fundamentally sportswear, however one describes that, however one defines that. Certainly the idea of sportswear has changed over the years. It's, I think, more of a mindset than a style, really. And I think that mindset is rooted in the idea of sort of an egalitarian approach to style. You know, it really started as a kind of answer to couture.
In the 90s, American fashion was globally popular. It was casual, cool, and universal. But to understand the importance of how revolutionary that was, we have to go back to the early 20th century.
Couture was really the standard of fashion, and women of a certain social set would go to Paris and they would get their wardrobes for the next season. Those wardrobes were quite involved to create, and it was really a garment that was crafted to your body. It was made specifically for you based on the creative impulses of a designer, and those ideas trickled down.
Really, we hardly like to do it. It seems a shame to talk about fashions, but this is what the well-dressed American girl is going to wear in the autumn. No, there isn't much new about the fashions. It just depends how you wear what you've got.
And so even if you were a woman who did not have the finances to indulge in couture, you were still kind of held hostage to the sensibility of those houses. American fashion at that point was really in the business of just copying, knocking off, watering down French fashion.
So there was a window of time in the early 40s when
the Germans entered Paris. Drama, history.
Paris was occupied by the Germans, and fashion information was blocked. There was no real fashion information coming out of Paris. It was effectively blockaded. So the American copy industry was rather stymied because their source of inspiration was simply cut off. So at that point, what happened is a genuine American fashion industry was created. And that was really thanks to some exceptional designers like Claire McCardell. Claire McArdle was an important American designer. She was an early pioneer of mix and match, for instance. And in 1934, a customer could buy 5 pieces from her collection, 2 tops, a long and a short skirt, and a pair of culottes, and make 9 different outfits simply by mixing the pieces. It was really quite visionary, but it was an idea that didn't quite catch on at the time. But by the end of World War II, Paris had resumed its position as the center of international fashion. In February 1947, French designer Christian Dior had just debuted his feminine new look silhouette of tight bodices and full T-length skirts. Dior had made curvaceous volume and structure popular again, which was a departure from the simple linear garments that America's designers had been making. Through the 50s, American stores resumed selling made-to-measure reproductions of Parisian designs. And once again, American designers were overlooked on the world stage. But McArdle continued to improve on her concept. Her designs were cleverly cut to fit various body types and to allow for more freedom of movement. And gradually, over the next decade, the idea of separates caught on. By the end of the 60s, there was some demand for this casual, comfortable style, but the American fashion industry was still not considered creatively on par with Europe's elite fashion houses. But the times were changing. And it was at this point that young designers Calvin Klein, Ralph Lauren, and Donna Karan started their careers in fashion.
And worked for a coat and suit company, Dan Milstein.
This is Calvin Klein.
Working for Milstein was really interesting because until Mr. Milstein had his first cigar in the morning, you didn't want to go near him. He would actually lift a hand and make a fist, and he was serious. So I learned that 7th Avenue was tough. This was not going to be easy, but I loved it. I used to speak with him all the time about going into my own business.
And so he did. In 1968, with a $10,000 loan from friend Barry Schwartz, Calvin Klein started his own line of dresses and coats that he sold at a coat shop in the York Hotel in New York City. Meanwhile, just a couple of blocks away, young designer Ralph Lauren had been working at the tie manufacturer Beau Brummel when he convinced the company to let him start his own line of ties. David Lauren, Ralph Lauren's son and chief innovations officer at Ralph Lauren.
When my father started, he had about $5,000 to his name, and they lived in the Bronx. They called under the L train. He did not know how to design, cut, or sew the way a traditional designer could, but he had a vision of the way he wanted to dress, and making ties was sort of a way to create a sensibility and an identity through his tie. And he was experimental. He would talk about going out and looking for fabrics that just were graphic. It could be a piece of tweed that you might see on a herringbone jacket and turning that into a tie. And again, people had just never seen a tie with these kind of fabrics. He really was designing for himself and for the kind of people that he connected to. He had a vision for the way he thought men could dress and the way he liked to dress. I think the symbol of a tie in that era, when men wore ties, was a way to express your identity.
Donna Karan, the youngest of the three, landed a job at Anne Klein while she was still in fashion school.
I was in my second year at Parsons, and I got a job at Anne Klein. I was about 18. You know, I became an assistant to, you know, getting the coffee, sharpening the pencils, that kind of stuff. And unfortunately, I got fired. So then I said, well, what am I going to do? And somebody, Patty Capali, hires me. It was probably one of the most amazing jobs that I had. She says, okay, get your passport. We're going to Paris. Now, here's a nice Jewish girl from the Five Towns who had never been anywhere, and I'm off to Paris.
After a few years, Donna Karan returned to Anne Klein and was promoted to associate designer in 1971.
So I came back to work, and it was just Anne and I. Then one summer, she said to me, you know, I have to travel. You need to do the collection. So I do this collection, which to this day is probably my favorite collection I ever did. It was in Bonwitella's Windows, and it was suede fringe skirts and shearling jackets, you know, and it was the beauty of it really was it was in season.
As an associate designer, Donna Karan established herself at Anne Klein quickly. In 1973, Anne Klein was asked to participate in an international fashion event held in the Palace of Versailles. And so her assistant, Donna Karan, prepared to fly back to Paris with Anne for what became one of the most important runway shows in fashion history. More after the break.
Hi everyone, it's Chloe, and I'm so excited to share something fabulous with you, Vogue's first ever global fashion community, Vogue Club. Our members get to mingle with Vogue editors, yes, including me, and fellow fashion enthusiasts at exclusive events around the world. And that's just the start. Membership opens doors to the fashion industry, bringing you expert career advice and insider style and beauty tips. What are you waiting for? Head over to vogue.com/membership to join, and here's a little treat. Use code TRT20 and snag 20% off your membership. That's TRT20 for 20% off your ticket to Vogue Club. Are you in?
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
In 1973, Donna Karan had just flown to Paris to assist Anne Klein in the fashion show that was soon to be dubbed the Battle of Versailles.
The original idea was that five top French designers would invite five American designers to Versailles to put on a charity fashion show that would be attended by sort of all the usual suspects in the international jet set world. It was Pierre Cardin, Hubert de Givenchy, Emmanuel Ungureau, and Marc Bohan, who was the Christian Dior designer at the time.
And these French haute couturiers invited five designers, Oscar de la Renta, Bill Blass, Stephen Burrows, Halston, and Anne Klein, to be their American counterparts.
It really didn't start out as a competition. You know, it started out as just a friendly fundraiser, but there was quite a build-up to it.
We go to Palace of Versailles, where Anne was the only female designer, and we were meeting with the Parisians. I've never seen so many diamonds in my life. You know, it was, you know, 12 forks this way, 13 knives that way, all these glasses on the table. But it was no real food. It was over my head completely.
I mean, the setting was magnificent. You had to walk through, you know, the Hall of Mirrors in order to get to the show. You know, the French, they were to go first. And everyone, you know, fully expected that the French would sort of dominate. And that was completely reasonable. You know, I mean, they were on their home turf, basically. They were all couture designers, and couture was king. They had a really elaborate presentation that involved orchestras and dancers and poetry readings and Josephine Baker. They had everything except for lions and tigers and bears.
And all we had was Liza Minnelli and a black set.
They had terrific music. They had popular music. You know, at that point, they had sort of reel-to-reel tape. The music was recorded on one continuous tape for when the set had to change and a new designer's work would come on stage. And the one bit of instruction from the designers was just they wanted the music to be loud. You know, they wanted it to feel like a celebration.
It was at this moment that the Americans played their hand, with Liza Minnelli as a sort of MC of the affair. Halston, Burroughs, De La Renta, Blass, and Anne Klein sent their collections down the runway. With little pomp and circumstance, the simple American clothes, colorful jersey dresses and jumpsuits, floating chiffon evening dresses, and sequined one-shoulder gowns had somehow upstaged the elaborate French haute couture creations. The Americans had been underestimated as mere sportswear designers, but their colorful designs stood out against the simple backdrop. The Americans were bringing new music, personality, vitality, really, to what would have otherwise been a very formal occasion. This runway show even broke racial barriers, with 10 black models walking for the Americans.
And what the black models did, which was sort of part of the vibe at that time, was to bring the clothes to life, to breathe life into them. And it's not until the models started to move and twirl and dance and sashay that you got this sense of the magic of the clothes. Black models flourished, in part because so much of the black community was introduced to the idea of sort of high fashion as a form of entertainment and expression. They underscored the importance of the woman to the clothing. Whereas with couture, it was almost as if this idea that the clothing was paramount and the woman came after. The woman was just, you know, this conveyance for moving the clothes through the world. But with the Americans, the clothes were completely in service to the woman.
And, you know, in their clothes, everything was a button and a button and a button. I said, who can button you all up? And they said, well, you just pull these clothes on? They were shocked. You know, this was pull on.
It was a landmark runway that established American fashion and sportswear on the international scene. After defying convention and breaking barriers, the Americans returned home. It was the 70s, and the big three had all found footing in this changing fashion landscape. In 1974, Donna Karan became head designer at Anne Klein, along with Louis Dallolio. Meanwhile, by 1978, Calvin Klein had found success in designer jeans, taking on a classic American garment and elevating it beyond the casual staple that it was.
I saw denim as primarily about sex. That was a way for me to express the difference in the cut and in the shape of jeans. We were creating image through advertising. The first photo that I did was of Patty Hansen. I did a billboard on Broadway where she was on her hands and knees, and that incredible mane of hair was thrown up in the air. So the hair was standing up, and she was on her hands and knees wearing the jeans. It was a killer. And we put it up on Broadway. I thought, let the world see it. And then we followed up later on with those TV commercials. And I did them with Brooke Shields.
You want to know what comes between me and my Calvins? Nothing.
Calvin Klein jeans.
Sexuality was in the air. It was in the air in New York. It was in the air in nightlife. And I was a part of it. I lived that way. So it was reflected in my marketing.
This ad caused quite a stir. Some American TV stations even banned it, but that only served Calvin Klein. The allure of casual, sexy confidence had already been built around his jeans. He started selling formerly utilitarian garments like men's underwear and transformed them into coveted fashion must-haves.
I would say American, minimal, sensual would be sort of the words I would use to describe Calvin Klein. If it was underwear, jeans, even interiors, he was exactly the same. He used the exact same aesthetic no matter what he was doing.
Virginia Smith is Vogue's fashion director and had, at that time, been working for Calvin Klein.
I mean, one of the funniest things that happened when I was there was Back to the Future.
Just relax, Calvin. You've got a big bruise on your head.
Do you remember the scene where Michael J. Fox is wearing Calvin Klein underwear? And
I've never seen purple underwear before, Calvin.
She's calling him Calvin because he has on Calvin Klein underwear.
Why do you keep calling me Calvin?
Well, that is your name, isn't it? Calvin Klein?
That whole thing, that was not done with Calvin Klein. He did not know about it. Calvin found out about that when I think it was David Geffen, who had seen an early screening of the film from Spielberg. And he called up Calvin and said, Calvin, there's this scene, da, 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 da. And, you know, no one knew how amazing that movie would be or how hilarious that scene would be. It was pretty incredible.
Calvin Klein had already become an international household name. You could find Calvin Klein jeans, Calvin Klein underwear, and eventually a line of popular fragrances all over the world.
And I thought, what happens if we did a fragrance like this? A scent that would be masculine enough, but absolutely still right for that woman, and young enough and sophisticated enough, and package it in a way that was anti-fragrance. So the top of the bottle you would screw off. Rather, you know, it wasn't a fragrance bottle. It was more like a bottle, like a hip flask. And so everything about it was anti-establishment. Another factor was you don't ever use the word unisex. That was a no. You know, it was shared fragrance. Because something that you share, it's got love attached to it. It makes you feel good. Unisex is a negative response. You know, it's old fashioned. It never worked anyway. The only part of the world that I had to think differently was the Middle East. Because during those decades, you couldn't sell something that was sleeveless, a dress or a blouse. It had to be covered up.
As the Calvin Klein name became synonymous with a seductive minimalist lifestyle, Donna Karan was establishing her own name with the launch of her first eponymous collection in 1985.
So after Anne Klein, I said I wanted to do these little collection called Seven Easy Pieces. You know, when I did start Donna Karan, you know, I just wanted some bodysuits, some leggings, some, you know, wrap and tie skirts, you know, day to night.
Donna Karan's Seven Easy Pieces were versatile. If you bought the bodysuit, you could wear it with the leggings during the day and then change to the wrap skirt for night. It was a contemporary version of Claire McArdle's mix and match designs, but this time the world was ready for American fashion innovation.
It was this ridiculous success immediately. I mean, it was like, whoa.
After the success of her Seven Easy Pieces, in 1988, Donna Karan introduced DKNY, a more affordable line designed for a younger base. Then, in 1990, she introduced DKNY Jeans, entering the designer jean market herself. Her business was booming. And then one day, Donna was watching a movie that inspired her next ad campaign.
Fought worse monsters than you for years in Hollywood. I know how to win the hard way.
There was a movie that was out, and it was Joan Crawford. She stamps on the table.
Don't fuck with me, fellas! This ain't my first time at the rodeo.
And I get this idea, woman running for president, that's it. What I wanted to shoot was a story that would talk to people that was beyond fashion. It was about life. It was never about the clothes.
Donna Karan's 1992 ad campaign featured Rosemary McGrotha as the first female president. Rosemary wore a stylish dark skirt suit and oversized pearls. She was getting sworn in, looking impossibly chic and powerful, surrounded by men. It was an empowering campaign that resonated with a lot of women. That same year, Donna introduced the cold shoulder, a black jersey dress with cutout shoulders.
You know, when I showed the cold shoulder, I got a bad review on it. You take off the jacket and there's a hole in the shoulder. And Liza Minnelli came. She was the first one, comes to my, you know, the closet of discards. Says, I gotta have that dress. And she wore it on stage. But I had never done stage clothes before. I didn't realize the light would go right through it.
In 1993, First Lady Hillary Clinton wore the Donna Karan cold shoulder dress to an event at the White House.
I opened the newspaper, The Times, and Hillary was wearing the cold shoulder. And then it just became, you know, a huge, huge success. And Hillary wore, I think, a lot of my clothes.
For First Lady Hillary Clinton, it represented an embrace of modern American fashion. While for Donna Karan, it exponentially amplified her brand. And soon, her brand became synonymous with a chic, practical and smart approach to dressing. Sportswear for the modern working woman. This was the kind of versatile clothing a woman could wear in everyday life, from work to leisure and from day to night.
To me, when I think of American clothes, I think of a reality base, something that is a desirable. And what I was hoping today is that the people sitting in the audience would say, I want to wear it. That looks new. That looks exciting. I don't have it. I want it. And it works for me. And they're separates. They're easy. They're uncomplicated. You don't have to think about it. They're just beautiful clothes.
It wasn't long before you could find Donna Karan designs everywhere. In the White House, on the red carpet, or in a department store. And in 1993, Donna Karan became the first American designer to open a store in China, taking her brands Donna Karan, DKNY, and DKNY Jeans to an international market. American sportswear had come a long way since Claire McArdle's capsule collection in 1934. While Donna Karan designed a mix-and-match, day-to-night bodysuit-based collection, Ralph Lauren reached new levels of international success with the Ralph Lauren Polo. It was introduced in 1972 in 24 colours, and over the 80s and 90s, it became a staple of the American wardrobe.
You know, the polo player started on the cuff of a woman's shirt, where you might have seen a monogram. It was something that he loved and he thought was cool and iconic and caught your attention. But, you know, he didn't start with a sense of what polo was. When he looked for different names, thought about different names that would conjure up the spirit, and landed on polo, kind of randomly. He had never been to a polo game before, but he liked the spirit of what polo stood for, sort of English and very elegant and sort of this sort of spirit on and off the field, which would follow all of his designs and his philosophy.
Ralph Lauren had skillfully created popular demand for his patrician, sort of Gatsby-inspired sportswear.
The basic philosophy was about things that get better with age, things that last, things that you don't throw out. They become almost heirlooms. When you buy a Ralph Lauren piece of clothing, it's meant to get better with it. It is almost English in its sensibility that way, or European that way. But in many ways, they were American because he was able to sort of, just like America, sort of create a kind of hybrid of the cultures that he loved. And whether that dream is about the Wild West or a preppy New England sensibility or a downtown New York or an old England vision, he's been able to bring his vision of a better life.
In Europe, it was exciting to have something from America that seemed rather exotic, but at the same time, strangely familiar. Consider the polo logo. Polo is a sport of British royalty and the global upper classes, of course, but it became the symbol for this major American designer. It struck me as a British person that Ralph Lauren was able to co-opt an idealized British aesthetic and package it in a very seductive way. And then he sold it back to us. And he did that better than any British designer.
And that polo player has become almost a symbolic proof of purchase. It's the entry point into his dream. And you buy that shirt and you pay the premium on that polo shirt because you want to be a part of the bigger dream that Ralph Lauren has created.
The Ralph Lauren polo line catapulted the business to international success. Stores from London to Paris to Tokyo carried Ralph Lauren. In Italy, a group of trendy kids called the Paninari wore Ralph Lauren while they zipped around on their Vespas. In New York City, Ralph Lauren opened his 20,000 square foot flagship store in the famous Rhinelander mansion on Madison Avenue and 72nd Street. Meanwhile, just a few miles away in Brooklyn, Ralph Lauren Polo would find an unexpected, almost cult, following.
This is Thurston Howell III, Polo Rican, the Skillionaire.
This is Rack Low, one of the founding members of the Lowlife Movement.
The Browns Villain.
From 1988.
The Lowlife General.
We started out as, you know, young teenagers, 14, 15, 16-year-olds.
From Brownsville, Brooklyn.
The Lowlifes were a subculture born from hip-hop and streetwear. This group of teenagers in Brooklyn incorporated Ralph Lauren into this new burgeoning hip-hop aesthetic.
It's just living the New York City life and the hip-hop life. I mean, the low-life culture of style and fashion did not begin with Polo. It was always a b-boy style of fashion. Polo just became the one, you know? It was the most exclusive. It was so hard to get. It had so much variety. If you look, the clothes were made for, like, the upper-class preppy kids from Yale and Harvard. And, you know, some kids from the ghetto just took it, remixed it, and we made it our own, you know?
You had the Polo Mansion on 72nd Street in Madison. So we would venture out. We knew all the places. Like, we had Barney's New York. We knew all the places, all the major department stores that carried Polo. And we would just travel to these places. But, you know, as inner city youth, we couldn't afford to buy it. So we came up with strategies, you know, to get it in our possessions. And boosting was one of the ways we did it. You know, we would go into these major department stores and we would pretty much shoplift the Polo.
I mean, we are part of American history at this point. We made Ralph Lauren maybe the only brand to be worshipped religiously, not just collected in fashion. It's a religion.
What really attracted us to Polo was the way the color stood out, you know, the way the symbols was right, really big and bold on the sweaters or the shirts, you know? Those type of things really made people look at us in a different way. But through the Polo, we also created our own style. And that style is called being low down. And that means being Polo down from head to toe. I mean, from the hat to the socks, the drawers, the shorts, the shirts, everything's Ralph Lauren.
At the end of the day, when we went home, a lot of us went home to nothing. All we had was those rooms full of clothing, you know, with so many outfits I could change up 3-4 times a day, but I didn't even have living room furniture. I was living a dream because I would forget everything when I walked outside, and I'm the best dressed guy.
We were like pretty much walking billboards, not just for Ralph Lauren, but for all the major brands that we sort of like advertised for free.
The Ralph Lauren brand had permeated far and wide. You could find Ralph Lauren in Brooklyn, in London, in Tokyo. It was a global brand on a scale that had far exceeded the fashion industry's expectations. And a signature of Ralph Lauren's success was his brilliant marketing. Ralph Lauren ads were compelling and evocative, and they were everywhere. In 1993, Tyson Beckford was cast as the featured model of Ralph Lauren's fall ad campaign.
That was my biggest job to date at that time. I'd never seen myself in a magazine like that. So it was, I remember it being two pages. One was a like a centerfold shot of me and the other guy standing on the mountain. And then there was a solo of me in a red USA fleece sweatshirt. And I had forgotten to take out my hoop earring at the time. So it was very... And they left it, in the ad. It ran from Vogue to GQ to, you know, Men's Digest, Men's Health Journal, all kinds of different magazines that were globally read and seen, you know. And I had no idea until I started getting fan mail. And the first few years, I was reading pretty much all my fan mail. And I mean, it would come in, I mean, the bags were so huge and they were coming from Africa. It was coming from Japan. It was coming because my background is Jamaican, Chinese, Portuguese, Panamanian, Spaniard. So I was getting letters from all over the world, from people I'd never met, but people who saw my image, who gave them inspiration, made them feel better about their skin, their nationality, their background, which in the 90s, if you think about it, you weren't getting that from any other model, male or female. I remember people kept saying, "You're the boy next door." I was like, "Next door to who?" You know? And I actually didn't grasp the concept until later on, till maybe my next Ralph Lauren ad campaign. And I realized that I had given America new vision. The way the world looked at us was different. Back then, we were changing how young people were growing up, how they saw themselves.
In the 90s, American designers introduced the world to a new form of glamour. Calvin Klein turned utilitarian garments into sex symbols. Donna Karan empowered the working woman with stylish mix and match pieces. And Ralph Lauren created a staple that was as popular in the Ivy League as it was on the streets of Brooklyn. Together, these designers created a space for American sportswear on the international fashion stage. They broke the mold of what it meant to be a successful global brand by marketing the American lifestyle. Around the world, it was never more fashionable to look American than in the 90s. In Vogue, the 1990s, is presented by Anna Winter and produced by Jasmine Aguilera, Julia Doyle, Kinsey Clark, and Taka Zen. Our executive producer is Alex Kappelman, mixed by Rainhouse. Mark Guiducci is Vogue's creative editorial director, and Vogue's editorial team is Led Borelli Parson, Mark Holgate, Nicole Phelps, and myself, Hamish Bowles. Special thanks to digital director Annalisa Yabsley, vice president of audio Julie Shen, and Anna Winter. Please do subscribe to the podcast. It helps new listeners find the show. You can find additional information, incredible imagery, and episode references in the show notes or at vogue.com/podcast. I'm your host, Hamish Bowles. Until next week, in Vogue.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hey, Run Through listeners. Are you curious about what goes on behind the scenes at Vogue and in the world of fashion? Join Vogue Club, a one-of-a-kind fashion community where you can unlock exclusive access to Vogue editors, industry players, and fellow members, as well as receive expert style advice, tickets to VIP events, handpicked gifts, and so much more. Visit VogueClub.com today and get 20% off using promo code THERUNTHROUGH20. That's VogueClub.com, promo code THERUNTHROUGH20.